Time for Unit 3, Session 2 of our Gospel Projects curriculum. And today we get to study a priest of righteousness and one of the Bible's more enigmatic characters, mysterious and yet fascinating just the same. We'll be in a couple of different places, primarily Genesis 14, which we skipped last week on purpose. And then we'll also be in Hebrews 5, 6, and 7, mostly 7. With a little bit of Psalm 110. So we'll kind of be all over the place learning about this mysterious figure we get introduced to this week. And so this week's question is, who is Melchizedek and why does he matter? It's a question, if you ever read the book of Hebrews, in the middle of the book, chapters 5, 6, and 7, it spends quite a long time talking about this figure, Melchizedek. He gets a handful of verses in the entire story of Genesis, but several chapters of the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, not to mention a reference in Psalm 110. So what is the point of this person, of his character, and why should we care about him? That's today's question. So we'll start with the story of Genesis 14, which is a story of how God's servant rescues a captured relative. This is Abraham going to the rescue of Lot. We summarized this a little bit last week, but let me just kind of go through it again. In chapter 13 of Genesis, a story we also skipped, Abram and his nephew Lot pick out areas to reside. Their servants kind of had got to fussing amongst themselves, and they decide to separate themselves apart from each other a little bit. And Lot chooses the land in the region of the city of Sodom. And it seems to be a fertile and productive land, and so that's where he goes with his people. And then Abram takes the other direction, which seems to be a little less productive, but that's the way he goes. And so they settle in their respective regions and set up camp. Shortly thereafter, in Genesis 14, there is a king in this region, and there is a rebellion that starts against this king. There are five kings, or I'm calling them warlords. They were lesser kings, if you will. And they start a rebellion near Sodom. And so the king of Sodom and four of his kings that were loyal go to war against the five rebel kings. Okay. Verses 8 and 9 of Genesis 14 then pick up there. Then the king of Sodom, I believe his name is Chedorlaomer, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zeor, went out and they joined battle in the valley of Sidom with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Eriphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Eleazar, four kings against five. I may have got some of those kings backwards in the wrong spot just a minute ago when I was summarizing, but that's the general idea. There's a whole lot of kings running around. The short version is there's four kings against five, and if you get that part right, you're in good shape. There's a rebellion going on, and they're going to war. Lot lives in this same region, and because of that, he gets caught up in the events of this story. In the New Testament, 2 Peter 2, 7 and 8 describes Lot as this way. Abraham rescued righteous Lot, which is the story we're going to get to, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked. For as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deed that he saw and heard. And so when Peter tells the story of Lot, it describes him as a righteous man in an unrighteous society. And that he was, you know, troubled and distressed day by day by the wickedness around him. A question worth pondering that I have no easy answer for this week, but just wanted to put in front of you, is the question of engagement versus separation, right? We as God's people know there is evil in the world. What's the right way to respond and relate to that as we live our daily life? One option might be we could completely separate ourselves out from it. We could go live in a monastery. We could have a completely separate life. And then we wouldn't be tainted by the evil of our sinful world. But also we'd have no good influence on the world. See, influence goes both ways. So the only way to completely cut off the influence of the world on us is to withdraw from it. But that also cuts off our influence on the world. The other option is engagement, right? We go out and we get into the mix of the world, right? What's the bad news? Well, influence goes both ways. While you're out there influencing the world is influencing you. There's simply no easy answer to that riddle of how to be faithful to God in a wicked culture. And I think Lot's story is just an interesting example of that. There are Bible characters who do, I would say, a better job of it than Lot. Daniel is a character who engages the culture of Babylon in the book of Daniel and remains faithful to his identity and his heritage and his God. Jesus is a person who eats with sinners and engages the world in that way. John the Baptist, on the other hand, kind of withdraws out into the wilderness. So it's a tricky question, but what is interesting, and the story is not necessarily addressing that, but it does make us ask a little bit about Lot's wisdom. You know, if you go and you live in Sodom, there's at least the possibility you're going to get caught up in the events of Sodom, and they're not good, and he was distressed every day. We could read in other accounts in Genesis of some of the things that Lot goes through while he's dealing with Sodom. We may get to that another time. But for now, it's just the beginning of a riddle of how are God's people going to do this? We could wander around the world like Abraham and not settle down in these cities. Or we could be like Lot and we get caught up in the trouble of those cities. And it's a struggle. That struggle comes to a head in verses 10 through 12. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who is dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. So just wrong place at the wrong time. He was dwelling in the land of Sodom. It was a place of wickedness and violence and all manner of bad things. And as that's unfolding, he gets caught up in it. He didn't ask for it, except he kind of did. I mean, he moved there. But there's no indication that he had any particular role on the politics of Sodom. But just by being around and being noticed, he gets caught up into it and he gets kidnapped, basically taken captive, and all of his provisions and wealth goes with him and his relatives. So there's a consequence. The consequence of living near Sodom is getting caught up in Sodom's wars and turmoil. So again, back to that question of how do we as Christians engage in this world? If you're going to be out there engaging in the struggle for our culture and our society, there are consequences to that and not all of them good. And so again, I don't think this gives us an answer to that question. It does raise it, and I thought it was worth mentioning. Our interest, though, is what Abram does in response to that. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. So Abram is informed that Lot has been taken captive. Side note here that took me down a little hour-long excursion in my Bible study prepping for this. Abram the Hebrew. This is the first time that anyone is called a Hebrew in the Bible. It's the first usage of the word Hebrew. Hebrew comes to me a synonym for the people of Israel, their identity. They are Hebrews. Paul in Philippians 3 will say, I am a Hebrew of the Hebrews. It's who they were ethnically. This is the first time the word is used. So what is it that gets Abraham, or Abram in this case, called a Hebrew, and what does that mean? We're not really sure where the term comes from, though we have two pretty good guesses, and it could be both. It could be a play on words. First off, there is an ancestor of Abram mentioned a couple of times in Genesis 10, 21-25, and 11, 14-17, whose name was Eber. So Hebrew may be a way of saying he's a descendant of Heber. That could be all it means. However, there are words in that world, in the ancient languages, Erebu, and related words, that seem to be connected to Hebrew, that have a meaning, and they specifically mean one from the other side of the river. Somebody who crossed the river, which comes to mean something like a migrant. So think of some of the pejorative expressions we have in English. Someone who comes over the Rio Grande River from Mexico, someone might condescendingly and rudely say that person's a wetback. And what that means is that is a person who crossed the river into the United States from Mexico. Not a very nice term, right? But that phrase wetback is cross the river. It's a river crosser. Or if you live in a particular town where maybe there's a poor neighborhood down on the other side of the tracks, you say, well, they're from the other side of the tracks. That's an old expression we don't use anymore. But we have lots of terms in English that we might use to describe someone from that other place. Someone from a place that's not us. They're migrants, they're foreigners, they're people kind of on the fringe of society, the people from the other side of the river. And it seems like the word Hebrew means something like that. That before they came to be a nation or tribes and have these lands and conquest and all that, they were just the migrants. They were the people wandering around. That's what Abram is. Abram has left his homeland over on the other side of the Euphrates River, and he's come over to this land, and he's just wandering around. And it could be that that name simply meant he's the guy from across the river. He's the guy from over there. He doesn't belong here. And the Bible even kind of points at that heritage a few times. The tail end of Deuteronomy chapter 26 and verse 5, it says, you need to remember this about Abram. And you shall make response before the Lord your God, a wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there became a nation great, mighty, and populous. Right, before he was a great nation, he was just a nomad. He was just a wanderer. He was just meandering around, okay, a transient. And then listen to Joshua 2:2-3. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, long ago your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, right, the river Euphrates, Terah, the father of Abraham and of Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led them through all the land of Canaan and made his offspring many. I gave him Isaac. So you were from over there. I brought you over here. You're the over the river people. You're the people that came from beyond the river. You're from over yonder. Joshua 24 does the same thing. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that your father served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. Remember when you were on the other side of the river? You folks are from over there. So it could just be a way of remembering their heritage. Don't get too full of yourself. You're the over the river people. You used to be over there and now you're here, and be glad to be here. God brought you here. After then, that's, I know, a long excursion. Back to our story, Abram, the Hebrew, hears that his nephew Lot has been taken captive. And the text says, when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all of the possessions and all his kinsmen, Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. Okay. So he takes a little strike force out, not a huge number, but a sizable number, 318, and they go and reclaim from this big rebellion mess his nephew Lot, and with Lot all the family, and with the family all their possessions. Probably just worth noticing that it would have been easy for Abram to leave Lot to the consequences of his own choices. Remember, how did the story start? Lot decided to go live down by Sodom because it looked better than the place that Abram was going to go down and live. okay, you made that choice, you went over there, and then because you went over there, you got caught up in their politics, and because of that, you got caught up in their war, and hey, tough cookies, that's what you get for choosing to live over there. It would have been easy for Abram just to say, sorry, kid, that's the way it goes. Even to be a little spiteful about it, we wouldn't blame him, maybe. Abram is a better man than that, and he goes and he rescues Lot from the consequences of his own choices, which I think is a beautiful picture of the kind of thing God's people often do and often need. So with that story in mind, after Abram has successfully rescued Lot, finally we get to the scene that our study is actually about, this person Melchizedek. God's servant is blessed by a priest to God Most High. This begins in verse 17. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. So think about the story now as preceding the law of Moses, long before the establishment of any kind of Levite priesthood, the descendants of Aaron, or any of those things. Out of nowhere pops this strange character described as Melchizedek, king of Salem. He is priest of God Most High. So first off, his name is kind of amusing if you're reading it in Hebrew. Melchizedek, Melech is the first half of that name, which is the Hebrew word for king. And Zedek is the second half, which is the Hebrew word for righteousness. So the name Melchizedek, Melech Zedek, is king of righteousness. That's a pretty cool name, king of righteousness. But even more, he's the king of Salem. Salem is connected to the word shalom. This is the king of peace. The king of righteousness is the king of a city called peace. And then add to that, Salem would later on in history, we think, be Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And so he's the king of Jerusalem before Israel's there, before there's a nation, before David takes the city and makes it his capital. There is a king of the city of Salem, which was Jerusalem. So now think about why this might be kind of a curious figure. The king of righteousness, the king of peace, the king of Jerusalem before it was Jerusalem. That's kind of a cool set of descriptions for one particular person. In the New Testament, then, the book of Hebrews points to that and kind of plays with his name. He is first, speaking of Melchizedek, by translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then he is also king of Salem, that is, king of peace. And so that name business is of interest to the Bible reader, that it kind of points to him and says, this might be an interesting figure. He's got a cool name. Not only is he a king of righteousness, king of peace, king of Salem, he's also a priest. Well, again, long before any Levites walked around, before any rules from Leviticus about how to be a priest, the text says he is priest of God Most High, not priest of some pagan god. He is priest of El Elyon, the God Most High. As the text says, he is the possessor of heaven and earth. That's how you describe the God of Abram. He blesses Abram in God's name and worships God. He does so in a way that we would recognize it and say it sounds like worshiping the true and living God. And then at the end of the verse, he even receives a tithe, a tenth contribution, a sacrifice, if you will, from Abram, which is the kind of thing a priest would do. So Melchizedek is acting as Abram's priest. The king of righteousness, king of peace, king of Salem, Jerusalem, and now priest of God, priest to Abram. That's, again, pretty cool set of descriptions. So again, in Hebrews, in the New Testament, it kind of wants to point to that and says that's the fascinating set of, I don't want to say coincidences, but of conditions for a man. The text says, it is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. Okay, so blessings go downhill. So the priest blesses someone in a lesser station than him. So when Melchizedek blesses Abram, that elevates him. Like Melchizedek has a rank above Abram. And then the text says, one might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. So if you think Levi's great, well, Levi is less than Abraham. Levi's the great-grandchild of Abraham. And Abraham is less than Melchizedek. So whatever you think about the priest of Levi, they can't be any better than the priesthood of Melchizedek, because the great-grandfather of all Levites is blessed by Melchizedek. So again, it's a kind of curious set of circumstances. And then a third thing, put these two thoughts together. He's a king and he's a priest. He's a king and a priest. That's odd. Later in the story of Israel, the first king of Israel would be from the tribe of Benjamin, named Saul. But all the future kings would be the descendants of David of the tribe of Judah. Kings come from Judah. Priests come from Levi, specifically the descendants of Aaron in the tribe of Levi, the Levites. Throughout history, those had always been kept separate. In the years after the Babylonian captivity and the return in the era of Nehemiah and Ezra and others, down to the period of the Maccabees, this becomes of some significance because there isn't a king as such. And the priests kind of start to run the show. And so it's very important for them to establish their credentials. What kind of priest are you? What's your lineage? Are you a Hasmonean priest? Are you a descendant of Zedek? Are you a descendant of, you know, a Zedekite priest? You know, what kind of priest are you? Give us your credentials, because without a king, the priests are kind of running the show. But it was still understood that there was a distinction between the promise of the lineage of David that came in the tribe of Judah and the priests of Levi. But in contrast, this unexplained man, Melchizedek, who just kind of drops out of the sky, with no obvious lineage, is both. Who are Melchizedek's parents? We have no idea. I don't think the text is trying to say he doesn't have parents. I think it's trying to say, we don't know who they are. He doesn't have a lineage. He doesn't have a big backstory. He just pops out of nowhere without any of the things that made a priest significant in the days of the New Testament, the first century, without any of those things. Melchizedek is already a priest of the Most High, and he's a king. He's king and priest. So this idea of a priest king lives on in the history of the Old Testament as a promise of things to come. Zechariah, who's one of the later prophets, says that someday it is he who shall build the temple of the Lord and shall bear royal honor and shall sit and rule on his throne, and there shall be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. Someday God would establish a king who would also be priest. Kind of a throwback to this idea of Melchizedek, the priest king. But someday the temple will be honored by having a priest who is also a king. And that idea lives on. And then to kind of wrap up the idea of Melchizedek, we don't know where he came from and we don't know where he went. You can read the whole rest of the book of Genesis, and it doesn't say, and then Melchizedek died. I mean, every other priest, you know where his parents are, you know where he came from, and then he reigns as priest or serves as priest so many years, and then he dies, and then this is the next priest. We don't get that about Melchizedek. He just kind of pops into the story out of nowhere, and then he leaves again, and that's that. So again, Hebrews 1 through 3 says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, and to him Abraham apportioned a tenth of everything. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. And again, I read that carefully. I don't think it's saying literally he had no father or mother. I think people have read that into it, that he wasn't born or that he never died. What it's saying, I mean, notice the word genealogy. He doesn't have a genealogy. We don't know who his people are. every other priest, we can tell you he's a descendant of this person, who's a descendant of this person, who's a descendant of this person. And we can tell you when he died and when the next guy took over. That's how the priest works. It's a succession, except Melchizedek. We don't know who his people are. We don't know how his story ends. He just pops into the story and then he disappears again. And so the New Testament then draws on that idea to point to Jesus. So their third point today then about the significance of Melchizedek is that God's priest Melchizedek points to an even greater priest to come. And this comes to us from Psalm 110, verses 1 through 4, which is a remarkable psalm on its own. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power and holy garments. From the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Psalm 110 is the promise of a future ruler, a Lord. The Lord said to my Lord, a Lord greater than David himself, a future Lord who would be a priest and who would be a king. And specifically, it says, you know, like old Melchizedek was. So we get a few verses in Genesis, and then kind of out of nowhere, Psalm 110 says, we need another Melchizedek, and God's going to give us one. Like the end of Melchizedek, we'd never read the story of the end of this priest-king's reign. You're a priest forever, and you just get to stay priest because no one's going to replace you. That story has no end. So again, Hebrews 7, 1-3 draws on all of that concept and paints a picture for us. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, he is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. And then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. He is without father or mother, a genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Again, he doesn't say he is the Son of God, but this figure starts to look like what we think of Jesus. He's a forerunner. Hebrews is not saying Jesus is Melchizedek reincarnated, or that Melchizedek is Jesus pre-incarnated or any such thing, but rather Jesus follows the precedent of Melchizedek and the promise of a priest-king. So what's the argument going on in Hebrews? In the first century, you had people who were of Jewish descent who were following Jesus. And then there's other groups of Jewish people who are still going back to the temple and the Levitical priests. And they're complaining about these Christian Jews saying, you know, hey, you've abandoned the priesthood and the temple and all the good things we have under the law. And the book of Hebrews is saying, oh no, we haven't abandoned them. In fact, we surpassed them. What we have is better than what you have. Christ is a priest. And in fact, he's a better priest. Jesus is a priest, not because he's of Levite. He's not. Admittedly that. He's a priest like old King Melchizedek was a priest. The priest we've been waiting for all this time. Verses 14 through 17 says, for it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah. And in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. So you can see the point. You're absolutely right. Jesus is not a Levite. So do we have no priest? Oh, no. He says this becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Quoting Psalm 110, he says, Jesus is a priest not because he happens to be the descendant of Aaron and Levi and that tribe, but because he was chosen by God and given a role in life, the same as Melchizedek was. Like Melchizedek, Jesus does not serve as a Levitical priest. Like Melchizedek, Jesus serves as a priest-king. How is that important for us? Well, the former priests, the Levitical priests, were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. Okay, so in other words, every priest eventually dies, and then someone else takes their spot. But he, Jesus, holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So in the same way, in the Melchizedek story, you never read about the end of the priesthood of Melchizedek. No, it's not saying literally Melchizedek is still wandering around somewhere. But you never read the end of his story. You'll never hear the end of the priesthood of Jesus either, because he has this indestructible life. That makes Jesus the greatest possible priest, a forever priest. For it is indeed fitting, verse 26, that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Every priest we've ever had under the Levitical system, those were imperfect priests. The law of Moses made imperfect men to be imperfect priests. They offered sacrifices day after day after day for themselves, because they were sinners, and for the people. But the promise of Melchizedek made a perfect man to be a perfect priest. And he doesn't offer a sacrifice for himself, because he's perfect. And his sacrifice that he offers is himself, and it's perfect. He makes one offering forever, and he's done. He's the perfect priest. He's a Melchizedek priest, not a Levite priest. So Hebrews wraps up the point and says, now the point in what we are saying is this. Good, because what's the point? We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places and the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. So you say, well, you Christians don't have a priesthood. You don't have somebody serving in the temple like we do over here in the Jewish system. The author of Hebrews says, oh, we have a priest. He's also a king. He's a priest, he's a king, he's on his throne, and he's not in that temple over there, he's in the real temple in heaven, doing his job for us, serving the people he rules. What a perfect priest we have, and what a great story we get from the story of Melchizedek, which shows us something new about Jesus we didn't even know we needed to know.